At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today we have a guest, Dr. David McCarty, and he is a specialist in sleep apnea. Now, I know you've probably heard a lot about sleep apnea already when we talk about sleep, but the reason I have Dr. McCarty on is he has a very unique view of sleep apnea and a very deep understanding, and I think you're really going to enjoy what he has to say. So, Dr. McCarty, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you. So I want to show everybody real quick. This is a book that Dr. McCarty has written. It's called Empowered Sleep Apnea, and it is not only loaded with a lot of cartoons and stories and poems and things, but it's loaded with really good information that is something that most people probably never get in their training. I'm talking about the professionals now, not just the individuals with sleep apnea. But why don't we start off with you telling us what brought you to write this book in the first place?
Well, thank you for that question. It started with the idea that there was a curriculum that I had worked out with my patients in clinic. And this curriculum, I'll refer to it as the Empowered Sleep Apnea Curriculum because that's what it's become. But it was a curriculum that was designed to give people an idea of what this complexity was like. Because we'll get back to this notion later, but sleep apnea, and I will contend all of sleep medicine, really is a complex territory of decision making because one doesn't know yet what one does not know. You know, so it's a territory that must be approached with a lot of circumspection and with a lot of probity on the part of the provider. And one needs to co-investigate this with the patient. So anyway, teaching this complexity to other human beings is a difficult thing. And I found that I could do it in person because I'm a personable guy and I'm not a bad teacher one-on-one. But I started to realize that as I was teaching this curriculum to patients one-on-one, I was making progress with them, but at the same time, it was too slow. I needed to get this curriculum out to more people than just one patient at a time, you know? So this is where the concept of, well, how is it done then? If it's not me in person being a personable guy and smiling and writing things down, that's easy to engage with. But when you try and put this information into a textbook, it becomes almost impenetrable. And I attempted that process for about 6 months. I tried to take all these teachings and put it into something that, you know, could be consumed kind of like a text. And every time I came back to it, it was unapproachable. You know, so this book was the outgrowth of a really curious process of creativity that is, how do we get this complexity across to people, you know, in a way that makes sense and in a way that people actually are drawn towards rather than pushing away from, you know?
Yeah, and I got to tell you, you're already kind of speaking a different language. And what I mean by that is you're talking about educating your patients. You're talking about explaining what's really going on. the traditional thing that I hear from patients is, well, I went in for a sleep study. They told me I had sleep apnea. They gave me this prescription for a machine, and now I got to figure it out. And that's what I hear so many times over and over and over. So why the different approach with you?
Well, you know, I call that the label-based system. It's kind of a result of the way we deliver care in this country is that we, you know, the way it's delivered is that it has to be something that's considered a reimbursable diagnosis. So there's a lot of energy and intellectual effort put into, do you fit into this category or not? You know, am I going to be able to get this treatment for you or not? There's a lot of gamesmanship that goes along with it. That's part of the psychology of medicine these days. And unfortunately, you know, that leads to some problems on the part of the patient's experience. It becomes a less humane experience when it's reduced to a label. So what this whole empowered sleep apnea program is about is it's really about reestablishing the patient's contact with their own narrative so that they understand what's going on and that they understand why these things are being done. And that helps provide what I call agency, which is the idea that they have some power in the whole process. They understand what's being done and why, and that there are choices to be made along the way. Some, you know, some choices carry more weight than others. And all the empowered sleep apnea curriculum is it's a structure to deconstruct that complexity in a way that providers and patients can both get their hands around.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I really appreciate that approach because I know that the people that I speak with are just kind of bewildered about what this sleep apnea thing means. And I know, you know, from my own research that about 50% as high as 80% of people who are diagnosed with sleep apnea and given a CPAP may try it or may not try it at all, but eventually they stop very, very shortly after starting because they find it to be uncomfortable and they don't really understand what the problem is because I feel okay. So why do I need this thing? So can you help us understand a little bit more about why this is so important for you to educate people about these issues?
Well, you know, sleep apnea as a diagnostic label, unfortunately, carries no specificity at all. So if one is labeled with this diagnosis, sleep apnea, as one has a high likelihood of being these days, because the diagnostics are now out there, the awareness is now out there, lots of people are being sent for sleep tests, it's quite possible you're going to come home with that label, you know, affixed to your forehead, sleep apnea. And probably it's going to be obstructive sleep apnea. In the ICD-10 in the United States, that's G47.33, you know. But the problem is that once that label is affixed, it doesn't really tell you anything about that patient, you know, because of the broad spectrum of disease, even within the obstructive pathology. But this comes with the understanding that the label sleep apnea invariably comes with some admixture of obstructive and central sleep apnea mixed together. This is the part that's so hard to get one's head wrapped around, is that these physiologies are not distinct, you know. So when one gets a label called sleep apnea, one must remember that within that label, within that number, let's say it's the apnea hypopnea index, which is a common metric of severity, within that label is a whole world to explore that includes two different flavors of sleep apnea potentially. Because here's the problem. We can spot and score central apneas very well on a sleep study. We can spot and score obstructive apneas very well. Okay, so those two, and apnea is just a pause in breathing, right? Whether it's obstructive or central makes a big difference, okay? An obstructive apnea means that the person is trying to breathe, and that trying to breathe occurs against a closed airway, and they can't breathe. So they're struggling, right? And so there's another word for that in English. The word is choking, right? The person is choking. That's different from a central apnea, which is a pause in effort that usually follows several exaggerated breaths, okay? Different physiology. Okay, so a central apnea in sleep is not necessarily portentous of the same kind of badness as an obstructive apnea. Okay, so that that point seems to make sense. But then we talk about the event known as the hypopnea. Hypopnea. Right. That word means under breathing, right? All that means is that for a few breaths, there's not enough air going in, and it provokes something else to happen, like the oxygen drops or it causes an arousal, right? And it turns out that those two flavors, obstructive or central, can be applied to the hypopnea phenomenon as well. Okay, you can have central hypopneas and you can have obstructive hypopneas. But the problem here is it's difficult to tell the difference with sort of standard montage equipment. So the best way to do it is you have to drop a probe down the esophagus called esophageal manometry, and it measures the pressure inside the esophagus. And, you know, ostensibly when you're breathing against a closed airspace, it's going to drop that pressure in the esophagus. So you can tell with a montage like that whether a hypopnea is obstructive or central, right? But if you don't do that, and most labs don't, if you don't do that, then most of the time what you get is a generic hypopnea. This person is having this many hypopneas per hour. Are they obstructive? Are they central? Well, we can't tell. So we're just going to report them hypopneas. And what happens in the culture is that from that point on, all of those hypopneas are presumed to be obstructive when you look at the number. And so here's the conundrum. I'll introduce a new factoid to you. Okay. And that is that central hypopneas can be driven by non-airway, non-breathing forces. I'll say that a little differently. Let's say we had a periodic source of arousal from sleep, okay? Something that caused EEG arousals every, say, 30 seconds from sleep. We give that person now monitoring of their breathing, and it turns out that some of these people, because of arousal from sleep, will tend to overbreathe with their mouth open during the recovery phase of that, during the arousal part of that, which will provoke an unstable breathing pattern, an oscillating breathing pattern. If this person happens to be of advanced age and they've aged their lungs because of going around the sun too many times or smoking a cigarette now and then or living in a polluted environment, that oscillation of ventilatory effort is now going to create periodic desaturations in oxygen. So I've now given you a pathway by which somebody with periodic limb movements of sleep, which is a neurologic phenomenon causing periodic arousals from sleep, that periodic limb movements of sleep can drive unstable breathing and can create an abnormally high AHI because of central hypopneas. Now, once we get our heads fixed around that that happens, and it does happen, now all of a sudden we realize, holy smokes, these people walking around with the label sleep apnea, man, maybe I shouldn't be using the term severe sleep apnea anymore just because the number's high, because I don't know what that number represents yet, okay? That AHI must be unpacked, right? So once we sort of get our heads around the idea that this is the complexity that we're dealing with, now the question becomes, how do we navigate that and how do we co-navigate that with not just our patients, but with our fellow providers? And that's what this Empowered Sleep Apnea Project is designed to do, is it helps people understand the complexity of these interrelationships so that the territory can be kind of more appropriately navigated.
So let me stop you and ask you two questions related to what you've just described. The first is you're talking about, you know, the label of severe sleep apnea, and the way that I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's just based on the number of apneas and hypopneas that occur within a certain set of time. That's the first part of my question. The second part of my question is, you talk about central sleep apnea and obstructive sleep apnea, and sometimes they can co-occur. Is the treatment the same or different for those?
Great questions. So let's first talk about the labels mild, moderate, and severe. This is a myth. This is a culturally perpetuated myth. And, you know, I would like for the listeners of this program, the watchers of this program, to question this myth from here on out. So traditionally, the way these terms have been used is for the apnea hypopnea index, which for a while was represented by the number of apneas and hypopneas per hour. And hypopneas for a good long time were just based upon 4% oxygen desaturations. Okay. So one thing that we have to start to understand with the discussion of the AHI is, you know, the definition of hypopnea has changed, you know? So the apnea hypopnea index is the standard measure of severity, but usually we're talking about the 4% desaturation criterion for the hypopneas when we use the terms mild, moderate, and severe. So mild would be an AHI with those parameters between 5 and 15. Moderate would be between 15 and 30. And above 30 would be considered severe. Now, why is this? This is based on some sort of actual cultural truth. So we have a couple of very good perspective population-based observational cohort studies. One's called the Sleep Heart Health Study, and the other is called the Wisconsin Sleep Cohort. And both of these were based on the 4% criteria for hypopneas. Both of them divided their cohorts up by these strategies, you know, mild, moderate, and severe, based on those AHI numbers. And they found that there was a dispersion of survivorship. So the longer you follow people, the more likely you are to die if your AHI is higher, basically. And above 30, there was a strong signal for an increased incremental mortality risk if the AHI was above 30. Now, so that's interesting.
I'm gonna stop you there real quick because we've got to take a commercial break, but I want to come right back to where we're stopping. So let's take a commercial. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today. You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we are back on Sleep Science Today with Dr. Dave McCarty, and we were into the explanation of the apnea-hypopnea index, so please continue.
Yeah, so this is a troubling metric, and there's a lot of people clamoring for it to be revised, and there's a lot of revisions that have happened. But what we know about it is that when the 4% hypopnea criterion AHI is above 30, there is a strong signal that sleep apnea represents an incremental or added on risk for early demise. You know, incremental meaning it's above and beyond age and gender and pre-existing heart disease and things like that. It seems to be an additional problem. So we can start to talk about sleep apnea as a mortality risk, something that threatens your ability to live a long life. Okay. But it turns out that we have to sort of decode that AHI greater than 30 carries risk. Because when we go back and look at, say, the Wisconsin Sleep Cohort, that cohort was made up of primarily middle-aged people as it started. Okay, so they weren't advanced age. Middle-aged people primarily, with very limited baseline incidence of cardiovascular disease. And it was done at sea level. Now, all of these things may be like, well, that's all fine. But what I'm saying in code is that these are people who have some of the risk factors for developing central apnea physiology events turned down. Okay, sea level means it's less likely because I live at 5,200 feet. We see a lot more central apnea physiology up here in the mountains. Okay, the older that one gets and the more aged and diseased the cardiovascular system gets, the more prolonged the circulation time gets, meaning how long does it take for one red blood cell to do a circuit of the entire body? That circulation time figures in the development of central apnea physiology events. So, you know, basically what I'm saying is when we're talking about that AHI greater than 30 carries mortality risk, we're talking about a patient population that was primarily informed by obstructive pathology for that number. We're not talking about that person we talked about last before the break, who has the periodic limb movements of sleep causing central hypopneas to occur. That is a completely different phenomenon. That is a post-psi type of overbreathing, underbreathing. And yes, there may be some stress to the system because of intermittent hypoxia, but it's not the same thing as choking. Okay, it's not the same thing as gasping on your upper airway. So when we're talking about decoding the AHI as a number, this is something we always have to get into. And the patient has to understand, well, they told me it was severe sleep apnea. You know, well, it's not that flavor. Okay, maybe we need to approach this differently. So the second part of your question is, well, let's say it is central apnea physiology, big shot. Let's say we knew that that's what was driving that AHI, that it was all central hypopneas. What do you do about it? And the answer is, well, you know, that's where the many moving parts shtick of the Empowered Sleep Apnea program comes into contact with our brains. You know, obstructive pathology has many moving parts. It's not just a floppy airway. It can have everything to do with the position and the function of the tongue and the position and posture of your breathing, whether your mouth is open or closed. Central apnea physiology is similar. Many moving parts. Okay. Whether a person is breathing through their nose or through their mouth can make a difference.
Right.
Open mouth breathing posture tends to promote that overventilation during recovery breathing. Okay. So sometimes it's as simple as functional breathing rehab exercises for central apnea physiology. Oftentimes where I live, they have to consider moving to a lower altitude or using supplemental oxygen to simulate lower altitude. Right.
Right.
Some other factors, if a person happens to be in atrial fibrillation, right, that prolongs the circulation time. If it's possible to restore normal sinus rhythm, and sometimes it is, you can go to your cardiologist and they can tell you whether you've got a shot at it. But sometimes just restoring that normal sinus rhythm can reaffirm that circulation time to the point where central apnea physiology gets better, you know? So once we sort of just get our minds through this idea that the AHI doesn't really tell us anything specific, that it must be unpacked. And then we can get into the discussion of the many moving parts, and then we can start problem solving, but only then, right? It's premature to troubleshoot and problem solve an AHI when that's all you understand.
Right. So then explain this to me, because that's really helpful and really eye-opening. But so if we don't know, based on the test we're doing, whether the person has the obstructive or the central apnea or both or whatever, all we're doing is looking at the AHI, the index. Then it sounds like if they had central only, that the CPAP would not be the answer. And I'm leading to a question here, I guess.
It may not be. So here's a backup way, because there are people who are going to be out there and say, no, I've seen central apneas get better with CPAP, right? Mm-hmm. And so the answer to that is central apnea physiology can be provoked by any periodic source of sleep disruption. That includes obstructive events. Okay. So sometimes the obstructive event provokes this overbreathing episode, which provokes this series of central apnea events, almost like a ripple effect. You know, and in that person, maybe you give them a little bit of CPAP and you relieve that obstructive component. The central apneas just go away. Okay. This is why it's so complex, and you never really know exactly what you're dealing with. So part of this process is that you're probing as you go forward, understanding how it fits together and seeing which narratives make sense. And the patient is doing that right along with you if they understand what the ride looks like.
So we're talking about the sort of the gold standard. When I say that, I mean people who actually go into a sleep clinic and get a full-blown polysomnography, the whole sleep test, the whole Megillah. And today, I know that we're moving a lot towards the at-home sleep test, which is not as comprehensive. And I know the insurers like that because it's less expensive and easier to do. I know patients like that sometimes because it's quicker and they can do it at home. But it sounds like we're leading ourselves down to an even more blind path. Is that accurate?
Well, it depends on whether you understand what's lost in translation or not.
Okay.
So when I say lost in translation, I mean that AHI number that comes out with the pretty green and red, you know, diagrammatic things that make it all seem so simple, that cased within that AHI number is a world of complexity, You want to understand that world of complexity. Let's go through the Empower Sleep Apnea curriculum so that you know that, hey, there may be some components here that aren't obstructive and they can be hiding in those hypopneas. Now, interestingly, there is a technology that's out there, and I'm not a paid proponent of this at all. I'm a fan. There is a home sleep apnea testing system called Sleep Image, and it's based on a technology called cardiopulmonary coupling, which is really fascinating technology that looks at the way the heart rate varies in response to breathing and in response to strained breathing of different kinds. Okay. And they found that there are patterns that exist within that, that machines can recognize that people can't, but it's able to sort of help untangle the conundrum of how much of this abnormality are we seeing here is central apnea mediated, right? Because that's kind of something you want to know. It's like, you know, I liken the generic AHI as you walk into a pizza store and they're like, well, you know, cockroaches on pizza is bad for you. And pineapple on pizza, well, you can make up your mind. So we're just going to give you a medium pizza. And you're like, well, how much is cockroaches and how much is pineapple? You know, and they're like, well, we don't know. Okay. And that's the similar, like in the AHI, you don't know how much is obstructive and how much is central. It's just an AHI. And and so you have to kind of be thinking about it. Otherwise, you might get led down a pretty bad garden path where you get severe sleep apnea and then, you know, you don't tolerate CPAP. So next thing you know, somebody's trying to cut your uvula out. And when if you had the, you know, the Lord's eye view, you would have known from the beginning that we were dealing with a central apnea physiology picture and we should be barking up a different treatment pathway, you know?
Right.
But if people aren't prepared for that, the label kind of takes hold of them and then the machine kind of takes over. And, once one gets labeled with CPAP intolerance, really it's kind of on for the more invasive and expensive treatments to be offered. And I think that's a situation we should all be very careful with, you know?
So what is a person to do if they have a sleep test, they're told they have apnea, probably they're told they have obstructive apnea, they're given this machine, they're having trouble using it, they're having trouble tolerating it. How do they even know if they really need it or what options exist for them?
Yeah. So these are the questions, my friend. These are the questions that are part of the curriculum. So this is, you know, this is going to sound like a plug, but it is. Listen to the season one of the Empowered Sleep Apnea podcast. It will give one the language necessary to understand the complexities of what we're talking about here, obstructive versus central, how to decode the AHI, and how to talk about one's own personal reasons to treat. Because that's what it boils down to is I have this label. Do I have reasons to treat? Okay. Is there a reason for me to worry about this? So this is the first of the 2 5-point paradigms on the Empowered Sleep Apnea curriculum. It's called the 5 reasons to treat. And those 5 reasons are risk, meaning is this going to kill me young? Snoring, which has all kinds of problems that go along with it, including social problems. Sleep, so the sleep experience can be somehow uncomfortable or disruptive. Wake, the wake experience can be somehow substandard, daytime sleepiness, fogginess, etc. And then comorbidities, meaning other health problems that if sleep apnea is there, they tend to get worse or harder to manage. Okay.
Right.
And so for every patient, before somebody is forcing a treatment in your general direction, the patient should be sort of prepared and ready to understand why are we doing this? And the whole discussion of that first reason to treat, risk, you know, is very, very difficult because of all of this flexibility around this notion of the AHI and what that number is and what it means. And so this is why the jargon of it needs to be very carefully decoded for patients. Otherwise, it's going to seem like a big shell game. You know, that doctor told me I had severe sleep apnea. You told me I don't have it at all. Well, it turns out those two studies were scored differently and they're looking at it a different way, right? But to the patient, it feels like a big game of, you know, let's fool you until you do what we want you to do. And that's not a good place for patients to be.
Right, right. Well, and this comes back to, I guess, really any medical issue, regardless of what it is the more educated the patient can be themselves about the issue, the better questions they can ask their doctor and the better understanding they'll have of what's actually going on. So, yes. You know, I do want to point out, you mentioned the five reasons to treat, and then there's another five-point mnemonic you have, which is five-finger approach. Mm-hmm. And I want to get to that, but let's take another quick break, and then we'll be right back, and let's pick up there.
Awesome.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, we're back on Sleep Science Today. Your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're with David McCarty, Dr. David McCarty, and we were just talking about treating sleep apnea and some of the approaches that he has in his book called Empowered Sleep Apnea. So, Dr. McCarty, please tell us, you were talking about the five reasons to treat and the five-finger approach.
Yeah, so the Empowered Sleep Apnea curriculum is basically designed to help patients and providers share an understanding of the complexity of what we're dealing with. And before I get to the five-finger approach, this is sort of the why behind that, is that we're talking about a complex navigational space. And what that means, it's different from the mere complicated. I'm going to use those two mm-hmm. terms differently. Complicated is kind of like the inside of a 747 cockpit. You know, to me, wow. there's a lot of dials and gauges, and I probably wouldn't be able to work it, but a trained person could and could get a reliable result. They know what mm-hmm. they're doing. That's complicated. Complexity is a situation that's a little more like a Peruvian rainforest. You don't know yet what you don't know. And there's a series of ants there. If you eradicate those ants, it might just kill the whole forest. We have no idea how these things are interrelated yet, you know? So this is more of a situation that describes sleep apnea and sleep medicine because the mm-hmm. symptoms are so nonspecific. Sometimes they exist, sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes the reason the person comes to the sleep clinic had nothing to do with the sleep apnea you found. It had something to do with something else. And you miss an opportunity to treat if you don't identify it. So this complexity is something that can't be done with sort of what I call a top-down management approach, which is I'm the know-it-all, fill out my survey, and I'll tell you what's wrong and tell you what to do. It has to be done with sort of a shared understanding of, you know, kind of what are we dealing with here? And that involves the patient understanding a little bit of the science and the jargon behind this, okay? Mm-hmm. But once that shared understanding is established, the patient then becomes the provider's 24/7 medical assistant. And they will have ideas that you haven't thought of yet, and they'll feel empowered to solve some of their own problems. Right. And moreover, they're more likely to stick with a standard therapy like CPAP because we're working on the other elements that really bother them too. So it involves for a very patient-centric approach. So with all of that being said, the five-finger approach to non-specific sleep-wake complaints is something that all of your viewers can find on the interwebs. You know, if you search five-finger approach sleep on Google, it'll bring you mm-hmm. directly to a PDF of my paper that was published in 2010 in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine. So this is a professional-grade navigational tool that has been published in the peer-reviewed literature. And the five fingers to think about. First thing one must do is establish sort of what we perceive as wrong. So we establish the series of what I call sleep-wake complaints. And I usually start this conversation with, are you satisfied with your sleep? You know, think about it, yes or no. And if mm-hmm. they're like, well, yeah, sometimes, but maybe not, and they give you this long-winded, then it's no. If they're satisfied, it's a yes. Otherwise, it's no. The next right. question is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 out of 10 is that sleep is perfect, gives me everything I need. I couldn't ask for anything more. I would love it to be this way forever. 1 out of 10 is it. I can't imagine this could be worse. Like, this is the worst of all situations I could ever imagine. You know, mm-hmm. give people the opportunity to grade themselves. And what I've found clinically is that when people give themselves a failing grade, like less than 70%, they are usually needing to talk about some stuff. And that's the gateway that opens up. Well, you know, what were you thinking of when you gave yourself that 4 out of 10? And then, well, you know, I snore so much. And then they can start giving you the reasons why it's not good. That's the sleep-wake complaints. Helping the patients discover that narrative is a vital first step, because the next step is, well, what's causing this? Once we understand it, well, I can't fall asleep for the first 2 hours. I get into bed, I just lie there awake. And then in the morning, I'm lying there and my alarm goes off. I can't even wake up. And I'm requiring so much coffee during the day. And I snore and my legs are feeling twitchy. Okay, wow, what's causing this, right? Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a complex narrative. For each person, it's going to be a little different. But once we have that narrative, it's up to the provider and to the patient to sort of preserve that. You know, hold that very carefully, because that's what we're trying to do here. That's going to be the protection against getting labeled with something and shoved onto the machine, you know?
Right.
So once we have that narrative, then we say, well, what could be causing that? Five-finger approach says that we test, basically psychologically test, five different domains to see if that could potentially explain what's going on with this person. The thumb of the five-finger approach is circadian misalignment. And and this is similar to the first step of my five reasons to treat. This is the hardest one to talk about, because it involves having an understanding of the way sleep works, you know, understanding the way the circadian rhythm promotes wakefulness and helps allow sleep. Where is that supposed to happen? So in order to teach circadian misalignment, one must talk to the patient about these jargony terms, right?
Right.
So part of
the
Empowered Sleep Apnea Project is it puts some of these terms into cartoons. For example, to explain the notion of this concept of sleep pressure, the longer you're awake, the more sleepy you'll get. This is an important concept because it's actually biochemical. You know, the more awake and active you are, the more stuff builds up in the CSF, cerebral spinal fluid, that makes you sleepy, you know? Mm-hmm. Wow, that's crazy. Okay, so you're saying that if I exercise more, I might get more sleep pressure. Maybe that'll make me sleep better at night. Yeah, that's pretty cool. But the way I teach this is with a cartoon. And this cartoon is available on our website and in our book. And it's a cartoon that tells the story of the fumes in the attic. Because this is a little easier to understand. When you're awake and under physiologic stress, that would include medical illness, by the way, but we are under physiologic stress, you're building up fumes in the attic. These fumes make you sleepy. When you open up the windows, that's like when you go to sleep, the windows open up, you create this cross breeze and it helps ventilate those fumes out. And that process takes about 7 hours for most adults to get those fumes ventilated out. So this concept is very easy to understand with the cartoon and stuff. And people say, oh, I get it. Why is this important? I'll give you one example. When I'm teaching people about cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, right? Mm-hmm. This is like, how do you think about the process of not sleeping, and how do you behave in order to make it better? That's what cognitive behavioral therapy is. One of the concepts is understanding how sleep works. And you say to people, you know, when you're awake, you're building up those fumes in the attic. Those fumes are internal Ambien, you know, that's what those do. So when you start to explain to a person that part of the treatment includes something called stimulus control therapy, which is where you get out of the bed and you go someplace else to do something that so that the bed quits reminding you of being awake. You go do something else. I usually tell people to go to their wind down area and do a wind down approved activity for 30 minutes. Just set a timer, you know. But the secret is, if they don't know why that's going to help them, it's less likely to help them. But if they understand, wow, I'm pumping out some of those sleep fumes right now, and all I got to do is sit here, I'll be more likely to fall asleep in 30 minutes. Then they're more likely to find success with it.
I'm just going to show, for those of you watching on YouTube, I'm just going to show a quick picture of what one of the cartoons looks like. Not the particular one you're mentioning, but this is a sense. So they're really, really helpful to explain the concepts.
Well, they're kind of sprinkled throughout, again, because complexity, I've learned this as a teacher. I was a teacher at the medical school at LSU when I was in the sleep program there. And I learned as a teacher that complexity is inherently scary. And there's two types of people in the world. One will try to keep up with you because they want to be as smart as you. And so they will feel threatened by it. It will make them a little bit angry to hear the jargon, but they'll try and keep up and they'll really work hard. The second group will glaze over and they won't listen anymore because they don't like to feel stupid and they'll pretend it's not important. Either way, it's bad, you know? So complexity, teaching complexity has some finesse to it. And that's what this book is about. It's designed to put it in a package that's not threatening, you know? It's plain language and gives you visual concepts so you can kind of get your head wrapped around it. And then once you get that complexity in your head, now it's time to start talking about, you know, details. Is a CPAP appropriate? Right. Well, let's go back and let's have that moving parts discussion again, you know?
Right. So I do want to share with the audience that these cartoons and other illustrations in the book, you did those yourself, correct?
Yeah, this is like my dirty little habit. I call myself the graduate of the school of torn up homework assignments. So as an adult, I sort of think of it as treating subclinical ADHD growing up. You know, I drew on all my notes and I would draw cartoons to illustrate how these things fit together. And, you know, when I was younger and my teachers didn't understand it, I got my stuff confiscated, you know, so you develop, you know what you're ashamed of when you cover it up. Right. So I would develop sort of this sense of furtiveness with these things and almost like it was a forbidden thing to do. So in a way, it's sort of awesome that this technique that I use to help myself understand is coming around to become a sort of a happy teaching tool that I can use to help other people too. You know, I love that. And I love that it's coming out of the closet, my cartooning habit, you know?
Right. Right. Wow. I can't imagine where you find the time to do all these different things that you're doing, but certainly well worth your time because it's really helpful to have this level of understanding.
I appreciate that. It's been great fun is the answer. That's how I find the time is that's been a sort of the official sub slogan of this project. If it's no fun, it's no fun. You know,
right.
We discovered this early on in the podcast process that I knew I had to get this curriculum out, but how? And very early on, I realized nobody's going to listen to this. If I'm just spouting off this knowledge, no one will listen. How do we do this? And Ellen and I, Ellen's my co-author and my partner in the podcast. Ellen and I said, well, you know, if it's not fun, .. it's no fun. And then we just took that. We put the zany goggles on and just went for it. And I've never been sorry. It's people have responded so well and people have reached out saying, you know, you've taught me so much. One of the dentists that reviewed our project for Cranio, reviewed the Empowered Sleep Apnea book for Cranio, said, I wish I'd started with this book before all the lectures I attended. You know, so we're getting great feedback from the world at large, from any silo of thought. And I think that's important because we're aiming for the Rosetta Stone here in terms of communicating complexity. We're trying to have everybody understand it and embrace it.
Right, right. Well, so, you know, we've only got a little over a minute left. So let me ask, for those patients that you personally have dealt with who maybe struggled with their CPAP or struggled with understanding why it's important to treat apnea in the first place, what do you think was the most useful thing for them and the number one thing that someone, if they're listening to this, should think about doing?
It's the five reasons to treat discussion. Absolutely. In the world of the Empowered Sleep Apnea Project, that happens at the Five Reasons Monument Coffee Hut, because the coffee hut is meant to be this liminal space. It's meant to be time free and you're not supposed to feel rushed. So I would say for anyone who's struggling with CPAP, understand your five reasons to treat. With the most important one to get your head wrapped around is risk, because the label itself, sleep apnea, does not tell you anything. The AHI must be unpacked. And the second thing I would say is know and understand the five-finger approach, because there are many, countless, unable to be counted numbers of other things that can mess with your sleep besides just the airway. And we got to think about those things too.
Right. Well, I really, really appreciate that. And I do want to also share with the audience that in addition to the cartoons and the other engaging elements of the book and the program, Dr. McCarty has thrown in a couple dad jokes. One of them being he's got the Isle of Sleep Apnea, i.e. the I Love Sleep Apnea. So you gotta kind of look for these Easter eggs throughout his work, but it is extremely engaging and I highly encourage it. So for those of you who would like to get a copy of his book, we do have a link to it easily on sleepsciencetoday.com/products. We put up the products that we talk about on that page. If you're listening and you want to know more about this, you can come and see the actual YouTube version of this episode just by going to sleepsciencetoday.com. You can sign up to be on our mailing list. You'll get a free ebook there and then extra notice of extra events and things that we do. So this is Andrew Kolsky with Sleep Science Today. Dr. Dave McCarty, thank you so much for taking your time to join us today.
This has been an utter pleasure. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.